This week's episode of Boat Briefing is sponsored by Amico & Co., the full-service refit shipyard at the heart of the Med. With large yacht facilities, in-house departments, and berthing in its waterfront marina. To find out more, visit www.amicoshipyard.com.
Welcome to the Big Boat Interview. I'm Lucy Dunn, Content Director at Boat, and this week I'm thrilled to have French underwater photographer and marine biologist Laurent Balestre as a guest. Balestre has not only established himself as one of the most important figures in underwater photography, but he's also a pioneer in diving techniques, known for defying convention and pushing to extreme depths for long periods of time. Balestre was a keynote at our Ocean Talks event. He's also won many awards and accolades and is famous for taking the deepest photograph ever taken by a diver, 190 metres. And this was the first photo of a coelacanth, which is a prehistoric fossil fish, which until quite recently everyone thought was extinct. Not content with just taking pictures, Balestre also plays a key role in ocean conservation, particularly around the fragile Posidonia seagrass meadows in the French Riviera. While this plant provides oxygen to numerous underwater species, it is continually being destroyed by anchors dredging the seabed. Balestre's now launched an app called Donia, which helps captains identify Posidonia locations and the best anchoring spots. This interview will be fascinating for anyone who is interested in the deep ocean and what can be found there. As one of nature's last great mysteries, you'll hear Balestre's life's work to help unlock some of its secrets. So, without further ado, and excuse the pun, let's dive in. So, Laurent, what is your first memory of diving?
I think, yeah, I have very, very old memory when I was a kid. So it's just snorkeling. I mean, just with a goggle and a tube and my fins, maybe not even fin, maybe not even tube, just the mask. And I remember to see a cuttlefish. You see what is a cuttlefish? And I knew what was a cuttlefish, but I knew and out of the water, on the fish market.
Yeah.
And suddenly, underwater, it looks like an amazing creature with these shiny eyes, with all the color moving on his body. And I remember that I followed this cuttlefish from the surface, and she went to a mask, a goggle, that was abandoned by someone or lost by someone. And the cuttlefish put all its eggs on the handle of the mask. Mm-hmm. So it was, and I was so scared. I wanted to take the mask because, you know, I didn't have any diving equipment. So when I found something like that, it was like a treasure. In the other hand, there was these eggs on the, so I was completely scared to what I do. And I was scared as well because I didn't know that it was a cuttlefish. But I was very, very young, probably 5 or something like that.
Okay.
But that's still in my mind. But then maybe one of the, another memory that changed a bit, a lot of things in my mind. I was much older, something like 17. And I was with a friend on a boat during the winter, and we were not really supposed to dive. We went offshore just to use our sonar and in the order to find a shipwreck that a fisherman give us a point approximately. And so our idea was just to go and back and go and back with the sonar in order to maybe have an image of the wreck and then probably later die. At the time I do that, suddenly at the far away, I saw a huge fin out of the water. Then another one, huge fin like that.
Yeah.
And that was a basking shark, well known in British Islands, by the way. but we were in south of France in Mediterranean Sea. I never heard about that. But as I was a kid, crazy of fish and sea, I had already read so many things about all the animals. So I said my friend that he was an adult. I said, oh, I know what it is. It is Cetorhinus maximus, the basking shark. He's eating on plankton. His maximum size can be 10 meters. All the lesson, you know. And say, what? Yeah, I'm sure I'm going. I go in the water. They are not dangerous. And I jump in the water with them. Imagine, I was diving for already a few years, but only in my poor place where I was fascinated by just a crabs or a small octopus. And just with that, I was able to make a long story to my family for hours and hours just with a little crabs. And suddenly I was swimming with 6-7 meters long sharks, 10 of them.
Wow.
And I remember that I stayed 3 hours in the winter waters. And at this time I didn't have any dry suit or this kind of. So I was completely frozen when I went out of the water. I had fever all the night, not because of the cold, just because of the emotion. All fever all night. And then all the week during, I start to have this kind of dreams and nightmare mix where I saw so many huge animals underwater. And I also test for the very first time that people in front of me don't believe me. And I don't know if you know the story of a little guy and the wolf who spend his time to make believe that the wolf come, and then at the end nobody believe him anymore and he's eaten. Well, that was the same. I was so used to tell story about my underwater adventure that it wasn't, by the way, that suddenly when I talk to my mother, father, say, yeah, I was in the water with huge sharks. Say, we, of course, we go to bed. And I realized that I need to have a camera all the time. And I never been into the water without camera nearly for the rest of my life. So that was a huge important. It's also the moment when I start to dream so much about underwater world. It's something that I talk with my body friends, divers, even professional divers, that don't talk to me about so much dreams. And me, I know that I make a lot of underwater dream. It's always the same. It's like if there is no water anymore. So you can have a view like when you are at the top of a mountain, for example, and you see all the valley, you see the mountain in front of you, you see the village very down in the valley, the river. You know, when you have this kind of huge landscape view, underwater, it's impossible. Even in the clearest water, you can have this so long view like that. And that's part of my dreams, because I think that a diver spend his time to like a puzzle, you know, he spends his time to put together his small view, to have an idea, to imagine what was exactly the huge landscape he just crossed. We cannot have this large view. And my dream are like that. And I think that even my photo techniques or what I like in photo come from this dream, because I developed this last year a way to make panoramic photos that allow me to see more, to watch more than my eyes. So larger landscape tend to put a lot of photo together and have a good one of the first wildlife photographer of the year that I get in London was in 2017. And it was this kind of panoramic photo. And for the very first time, you had a view of a whole iceberg, but the underwater part of the iceberg, and thanks to the technique. So it came from very far, actually.
Interesting. And obviously, what is your motivation for recording marine life with your underwater photography?
I have this deep feeling that the underwater world deserves to we must bring back images and stories, because it's just because it's not our world. You know, there is something more for me that's obvious, that I need to bring back something to just to continue to watch, just to continue to admire, just to continue to explore, because your time underwater is counted. You know, when I talk with a specialist of birds or a botanist or this kind of, and if I start to tell them, oh, I'm very happy because yesterday I spent 1 hour, 17 minutes in the water, they don't understand. This guy never look at their watch. They go underwater for longer time, and they stay and stay. They are not limited in their passion, in their job, and we are. So it looks to me very early that bring back images was something very a kind of necessity to continue to watch this world.
But obviously recording the marine life in these deepest part of the oceans has a purpose, hasn't it? I mean, for example, we know so little about
definitely we know so little. I mean, even what we know, what do we know except they exist? There is this kind of huge list of species of fish, shell, crustacean, I don't know, many thousands, and what else? For example, even the most known, take I don't know, the great white shark, the humpback whales, so well known, we know nothing. We never saw them mating. We never saw them giving birth. You know, imagine they are as famous as a lion, a giraffe, or an elephant. For the elephant, we know everything: where they born, how they born, how they eat, how they mate, how they die. We know everything of their life. For even for the most famous underwater creatures, we don't know nearly nothing except they exist. So there is so many things. So that's why my obsession is that there is something much more interesting and much more fascinating than the mysteries, the beauty of the sea. It's the mystery. For me, the beauty of the sea is much, and everybody is talking about the beauty of the underwater world. But for me, it's so less important and less fascinating than the mysteries of the underwater world. And by the way, I think that it's a much more easy way to make respect the underwater world, because you know during a few decades, everybody was saying we have to show the beauty of the nature. In order that people love, that they love the beauty, and if they love, they're going to respect, and that's a way of conservation. Unfortunately, I don't believe. Maybe it worked in the past. I'm pretty sure that it doesn't work anymore, or not so efficiently, because in our modern time, with all the social net, all the social media. This beauty of the nature is something that you can access every second on your smartphone. You see the beauty of the nature. And what is the consequence? The consequence is that, me too, I want to see that. Me too, I want to be there. It's not anymore when people had to go in a library or to go in a theater to watch or to learn about the nature. And now it's a kind of the beauty of the nature became a product of consumption.
It's almost like wallpaper. So yeah. And no one's looking at that anymore. Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that if we are able to show not the beauty of the nature, but the mystery, the mysteries of the nature. Show that nature is bigger than us. Show that it's impossible to understand everything happening in the nature. It looks to, and it can be a bit scary, by the way. And I say, that's better. That's much better. It's like, for me, you know, imagine a big population, mad of God, crazy of God, this kind of culture where people are completely on their knees in front of their God. They don't love God because God would be beautiful. They love God because it's bigger than them, because they are a bit scared by God, because they know that they are so small. They are under the power of their God. And we have to reconnect with that. We are under power of nature. And if I try something with my photos and my stories, is to try to figure out a little bit of that. Look how it's something that we cannot understand completely, that is so bigger than us. We spend our time to say nature is fragile. No, we are fragile. Nature is strong, because when you see what we do to the nature all the time, it should be dead if it was so fragile. You know, imagine we do the same to a little human population, is without antibiotic, without police, without army, without social safety staff, we die in a few days. So say that the nature is fragile, it's wrong. It's completely demagogue. There is demagogy to say that nature is fragile. We are. And so, I don't know if I success, but with my expedition, I try to dig a little bit around this kind of underwater mysteries. And my wish, I do that just because I love exploration. But if I can have a wish, is that maybe that's going to impress people to say, wow, the nature is so big, is so... And I think that it could be a much better source of respect than just to show that it's beautiful. When it's beautiful, they say, oh, I want to be there as well. I want to go. And in our modern time, you will always find tourist operator say, oh, you want to go? No problem. It's the flight ticket, the hotel, the cocktail, the warm towel, and when you go out of the water, everything is ready for you. Just have to pay. And that's not traveling, by the way, anymore. Traveling is not something easy. It's not something who has to be comfortable. Traveling is something tough. From millenniums, traveling is tough, is attracting, but if you want something comfortable, you stay home. Stay home in your chair. That's comfort. And this modern idea that you can travel and be in a very comfortable situation, it's something completely out of the rule, it looks to me.
Coming back to a different thing, because I just want to talk about this, because I think this is important for our audience. So you've been working on the restoration and protection of Posidonia seagrass meadows in the south of France. Can you tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah. With my team and my society, Andromède Océanologie, we spent 15 years to just make underwater mapping and the map of the seagrass meadows. And after 15 years, we had all the French Mediterranean coast map, and Corsica included. And it looks to us that we discover a lot of things. We discover that in some part, 50% of the sea meadow disappeared. In other part, it's 98% that disappeared. Yeah. And so that was very concerning and so we developed two things to do more than just show the problem. So first thing, we developed an app. An application for smartphone tablets that is called Donia, D-O-N-I-A, Donia, like Posidonia, the sea meadow. And with this app, you you know exactly where you can put your anchor with your boat. So it means that because it's for example in France it's forbidden now to put an anchor on the Simido, but sometimes people don't know where they are the Simido, where there is sand, where there is rock, and thanks to this application, you can know what there is below your boat. So you know that you're going to send your anchor on sand or mud or rock or on a meadow. So that's the first thing. And now this app is in the French law. And so it's really recommended to use it. And we have last summer, we had 60,000 boat users. So that was quite a good success for us. And of course, our project is to continue to have this app for not just the French coast and Corsica and a little. It will be at least to have it for all the Mediterranean Sea, at least the part where there is a lot of yachting, like in Greece or in Italia, in Spanish Balear Islands. And so we try to develop that, but it's been a first work of mapping. And this first mapping works is need a lot of time, need a lot of money, because it's, for example, you know, for a land map, you take some satellite photos, you give that to some botanist, some field check, and in a few days, you have a huge biological map. So we would like to continue the mapping of the rest of Mediterranean Sea, and why not in the future to go also in some other very impacted by yachting place, like in Caribbean or this kind of place, to continue this mapping and to increase the surface where we can use this very useful app. So that's one thing. But there is also the place already destroyed or still destroying each summer. And in this place, we have a project that is started 3 years ago called REPIC, where we try to replant the sea meadows broken by the anchors. And so it's a really tough work because it's meter after meters that you have to replant. But it worked. We do that for the last three years. And that's what we have, for example, in the La Baie de Golfe-Juan, close to Cannes in south of France, where there's a lot of boats during the summer. And we have a full team of divers, a lot of divers, and they spend that day to dive in the bay. And just they collect all the big piece of meadows broken by the anchor. They collect them. And then we have a dedicated area given to us by the authorities where we replant the seals.
So let's just come back to the mysteries of the deep that you were talking about. You're known for pushing to extreme depths to photograph marine life, and you've developed new techniques which enabled you to go deeper for longer. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So, of course. Well, I'm lucky to have a very good team around me. And some are very specialized in they develop a culture of what have been already done in the past. And you know that everything is forgotten so fast in this kind of industry. So it's important to go and dig some old experience to see what can be useful in the modern time. And thanks to all this thing and thanks to our training, we develop new techniques. It was the purpose, the aim was easy. It was simple. I want to stay longer. It's not even a question to go deeper. It's just to stay longer at the beginning. And that's the good way. Because if you are just focused on depths, you can't figure out, you're on the wrong way. First, the time. And because you have more time, you can imagine to go deeper. And so that's what we developed a long time ago, thanks first to electronic rebreathers, these techniques that instead of wasting your gas every time you exhale every time you breathe, you push your breath into the scuba again. It's clean. Some oxygen is added, and you can breathe again the same gas, and that gives you a much longer. So we don't invent this thing. One of the most famous rebreather come from England. It's called AP Diving, and it was really the very first electronic rebreather for recreative divers, I would say. Even if at the beginning we were just some few scientists to work with. And so that was the first step. But then you have on your back something that allows you to stay as long as you want. But that doesn't change your physiology. There is a point that you need to make decompression, that you have the sickness of the depths, all this kind of thing. So then you have to change the mix. So then you have to find a way to make your decompression faster, but safer as well. And so that's what we develop year after year. And then there is also, if you start to stay longer, you're going to be you're colder faster as well. So you need to find also a way to fight the cold. So you need other kind of suit, of dry suit with electric heaters in your underwears under the dry suit. You need, and it's nothing revolutionary, but it's a lot of little ideas, little step to stay longer. And the very last technique I developed, it was a dream, 18 years dream. It was to use techniques that have been only made for commercial divers on oil rig. This kind of system that because when you start to go deep and stay long, the problem is not to go deep, it's not even to stay long. The problem is the ascent, is the way back. You need hours, and it can be also days and days of decompression. So actually you can't, except if you don't ascend, or if you make believe your body that you are not ascending. And that's this technique. Instead of going up and have to decompress, you go at the end of your dive, you go inside a bell, a chamber, you close the door. Inside is still the pressure of the bottom. You go back to the surface, but anyway, inside the bell is still the same pressure. You connect your bell to a living chamber where there is a few beds and a table, and you can eat and rest, but the pressure is still the same at the bottom. So for your body, you are just continuing diving, but in dry atmosphere, and so you don't have to decompress. Okay. And so that was the way we hijack, because we don't invent the technique. But we use that with something different, is that normally the commercial diver, they are linked to the bell with a huge umbilical and a big helmet, and they cannot move. They are really stuck around the bell to make their job, to fix a pipeline or I don't know.
Yeah.
And my idea was to be free. So we use our electronic rebreather and we leave from the bell for hours and hours and hours. And then when you are too cold, you come back to the bell. You go in a warm place, pressurized chamber, you rest, you eat. When you are ready, you can continue immediately. And that's what we did already twice, 28 days the first time. So, of course, there is some issue. It means that you have to stay stuck with your friend in a very small chamber. For us, it was 5 square meters for 4 of us. For 28 days, so you have to know them very well.
Yeah,
and there is no windows. You're really in the box for 1 month. Your only solution is to go underwater. That's the only free space you can have. So it's a bit tough, of course, but that gives you such a freedom that I never had before. For example, I did a book with that, my last photo books about deep Mediterranean Sea. And I realized that half of the photos of this book have been done during these 28 days. Mm. And the other half asked me 14 years.
Wow. Okay.
And yeah, they are in the same balance, the same yeah quality. It means that 28 days was as efficient as 14 years of normal diving or normal deep diving. So that was the, for me, the best proof that this way to dive deep was efficient.
Have any of your pictures helped science in any way?
Yeah, they are always linked to study. That's why my expedition are half sponsored by private fund, because there is this kind of adventure hope and also aesthetic stories, etc. But it's also science, because I have also public money, because that most of the time there are not most of the time all the time there are linked to official studies for national parks, for marine protected areas, to make us for coastal management, this yeah kind of. So yeah, they of course they help. We describe all the, for a few years ago, it was thanks to the images that we describe how the gray reef shark socialize to hunt together. And that was mainly based on our pictures.
Okay, interesting. And one of the things that you are famous for, one of the most famous pictures, well, one of your very many famous pictures, is that you photographed a coelacanth. Is that correct? Which is that dinosaur fish. Tell me a little bit about that. How far did you go down to find it or them?
Yeah. Well, that happened in South. So you know that the coelacanth is called locally Gombessa. Gombessa is the name of my expedition, because since this dive, everything changed for my team and I. So I decided that now all the expedition will be called Gombessa Expedition as a tribute to this famous fish. And this fish was famous for different reasons. First, it was supposed to be extinct 65 million years ago, like the at the same time as the dinosaurs. But it's not just a fish that we thought it disappeared. It's also a kind of a witness of the transition from the sea life to the land life of the tetrapod, because this fish is part of the family that 370 million years ago went out of the water. He has already all the character for that. If you look inside his fins, there is already the beginning of all our bones. Tibia, femur, peroné, all these bones are already there. He has a kind of rest of a lung. He has all the character. But this one, the coelacanth of our time, didn't make the transition. He stay in the bottom, hidden in very deep ocean, and cross the time without to let any fossil, because it was living in condition that it's not the condition to give fossil. So that was a revolution when in the middle of the 20th century, one scientist say, hey, coelacanth still exists. It was as crazy as if tomorrow someone say, hey, there is a T-Rex in Siberia still alive. Exactly. It's not even, I mean, if someone tomorrow say that a mammoth, you see this kind of old elephant, a mammoth still exists, that will be unbelievable. Okay. But in the other end, the mammoth were still on Earth 20,000 years ago. It's nothing. It's yesterday. We are talking about a fish who was supposed to be extinct 65 million years ago. And we discover in the 20th century that it was still there. So that was a revolution. And all the paleontologists say he's going to answer all the questions about evolution, blah, blah, blah. But in the other end, this fish was unreachable, living too deep, very hard to reach him, very fragile, by the way. So every time they try to catch them, they die. So he asked, he give information like, you know, drop by drop. And for example, he was really clear in the 50s that a lot of coelacanth was living around the Comore Islands in the Mozambique Channel. But he asked another nearly 30 years for a submarine to watch them underwater. And he asked, we have to wait 2000 for a South African guy called Peter Tim, found the coelacanth during a deep dive. And he asked another 10 years for my team and I to go there and did the very first still photographs and videos in his own ecosystem by divers. So, yeah, so that was for me, you know, when you are a marine biology student or just someone in passion for biodiversity, marine life, the coelacanth is a kind of grail, is still considered as the greatest zoological discovery of the 20th century. So imagine the emotion when you arrive at the bottom and the coelacanth went out of his cave and just come to us, not very curious but not scared. And the first day, first dive, we had the coelacanth in front of us. That means that the difficult thing was not to find the coelacanth. It was here. The only difficult thing was to reach its universe. That was amazing, of course. And I'm still dreaming to one day to go back. But my dream will be to go back with the saturation system, in order to not just stay 30 minutes at the bottom for 6 hours ascent, but to stay all day during at the bottom with it. After that, I can stop my job.
So that's coming to the end. But are there any places still on your bucket list to dive? I suppose there will be.
Yeah, you know, I'm more a guy that want to do thing again in a better way. Then dream for the next. I can dream to imagine to find a place where there is giant squid coming close to the surface. This kind of crazy dream. But for the moment, there is not even one clue to find such a place. I'm still curious of the deep ecosystem of Mediterranean Sea. There is so many things that we could figure out. As I told you, we even with the most famous animals, we don't know nearly nothing. So that could be great to continue. I have nothing in particular. I want to continue to make known the horseshoe crab, this very strange animals coming from the night of time that not evolved for 100 million years ago. And in the other end, that it's so important for medicine in the modern time, as he has the only one molecular that can test all the vaccine for the human being. And this animal is endangered because of that. And in the other end is a fascinating animals that people love when they don't know it. That's why probably I get the Grand Title Award in Wildlife Photographer of the Year last year, because this animal is never photographed underwater, even if it's normally he live in mud, in estuary, in mangrove, in swamp. And so there is no vis. And I was lucky to find a place where they live in quite clear waters. So I could figure out something like that. And I would like to continue to study and report this strange animal as well.
So you've got lots of things to do.
Okay. Yeah, for sure. And take care of 2 kids as well.
So, thank you so much, Laurent. That's all we have time for. So thank you so much for coming on the Big Boat interview. And just before we go, as you know, lots of people, and I've just said that people in the industry will be listening to this. So where do you find the Donya app?
Oh, on Apple Store, on all the smartphone and tablets, you can find Donya app for sure.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Laurent.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoyed this week's Big Boat interview, and don't forget to tune in next week. This week's interview was mixed by Naomi Wilson.